Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello, I'm so delighted you're joining me, no matter where you are on this planet. Welcome. And know that we're going to be talking this evening about a subject matter that is very, very close to the heart and mind of my guest, who is Judy Mandel. She's a former reporter and marketing executive. When her parents died, she decided that it was time to write the story of her family. And also the particular aspects of the family dynamics that took her on a journey. It took her 3 years to be able to put this publication together, which is titled White Flag. Judy Mandel, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thanks very much, Donna. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you as a guest. Now, your family, there was so much tragedy that went on in your family, and it started with your mother, but there's all kinds of different aspects that when you started writing this book, I'm sure you gave pause to, gee, do I really want to do this? What made you finally decide to say, I'm going to sit down and write this story, perceiving that maybe it could help somebody else that might be going through their own family dynamics where they need to know they're not alone, that these dynamics can occur with anyone in any culture, in any family?
White Flag, the new book, is almost a continuation of what you're talking about. My first book, which was called Replacement Child, and that book is the story of my family in the aftermath of a plane crash that killed my sister, whose name was Donna, by the way, and gravely injuring my other sister, Linda, who was only two at the time. This all happened before I was born in 1952 in Elizabeth, New Jersey. It was part of a series of crashes at that time. And this new book is really about Linda's daughter, Cheryl, who had substance abuse disorder and sadly did overdose in 2017. And the idea of continuation is that her mother was going through trauma her whole life, from the time of that plane crash until her own death in 2009. And that actually leads to the responsibility I felt to take care of Cheryl, as, you know, my sister, when she passed away, you know, I held her hand and I said, she had two girls, and I said, you know, I've got them now, don't worry, before she passed. And so when Cheryl was in trouble, you know, I felt it was my responsibility to step in and help her. Writing the book I started shortly after Cheryl died. And I really wasn't sure what I was writing, but writing's always been the way I figure things out and answer some questions. And I had a lot of questions after that. You know, I had the questions. I think that everyone who has a loved one who has substance use disorder, I think we all have the same questions. What happened? You know, why did they use drugs? Why couldn't they stop using drugs? You know, very often we know they want to stop using drugs. You know, what could I have done that I didn't do? Mm-hmm. And those are the questions I came to write this book, White Flag.
When your book starts out, you go into some of the details about your sister, Linda, and so many things that happened, and that was just such a horrific tragedy when she was 2 years old and the plane crashing and the fire that resulted in burned her very, very badly, and she went through like 100 surgeries, which is almost incomprehensible to any of us that someone would have that many surgeries. But from the time she was 2 years old, they had to do what was necessary. But Cheryl was another aspect of the family, and right in your very first chapter, you talk about an envelope creased down the middle, and the return address is just Cheryl's name and inmate number. Now, how long had it been since you had heard from her?
It had been 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And I found her by found her by Googling her and finding a mugshot of her in prison, which, believe it or not, was a relief because at least she was still alive,
mm-hmm.
Which I wasn't sure that she was.
Mm-hmm. One of the points that you bring up about your family's dynamics is that in the family, depression was something that was generational. It happened generation after generation after generation. How were you able to find out about this?
You know, Dribs and Drabs came out about that, you know, that from my sister, I knew that my sister suffered from depression, which in a way made perfect sense to me. She had a very tough life, and it's almost, it wasn't a mystery that it was situational. She had a very tough time. I knew my mother had depression as I grew up, and I believe it was, a lot of it was because of losing her firstborn daughter in that plane crash. You know, there would be times I would come home from school and my mother would still be in bed in the afternoon. And she, you know, there were just times when she just couldn't rally herself.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say she rallied for me. I know she did. But I knew that there was this underlying problem, you know, with different people in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, my sister did tell me more about that. You know, my sister told me some of the secrets of the family, but some of them she didn't. And, you know, I had to find out some of those later on. And many of them were about Cheryl. You know, when things were going badly, I think my sister didn't want it to reflect badly on her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know all the details.
This is something I think that is in many, many families. And there is a situation that I know I recall relative to my own family history about various individuals that I discovered, and it was appalling to me. But everything had been very much closed down, lips were sealed, nobody talked about certain things.
Right, right.
And that's something that you encountered, and in a way, that was very, very difficult for you because there's a conflict when it comes up. You go, well, wait a minute. If this was going on, how come somebody didn't say something?
Yeah.
And
it's almost another trauma,
mm-hmm,
of
mm-hmm.
silence.
The trauma of silence. I think that's a very good collection of words. The trauma of
silence. You
know,
silence. Not being able to, not knowing what's really going on,
mm-hmm.
Being kept in the dark. And I think, sometimes with good intentions,
mm-hmm.
and in my family, the good intention of keeping me in the dark was keeping me separate from the tragedy that had happened before I was there.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to have a clean slate,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
I understand it, but it is another trauma,
mm-hmm.
of, because then when these things come out, they hurt more when you know them.
Whenever you have a member of the family that has addiction challenges, and I think David Foster Wallace, you have a quote by him, and it reads, "You see now that it's your enemy and your worst personal nightmare, and the trouble it has gotten you into is undeniable, and you still can't stop doing the substance.
Yeah.
Now it's like attending black mass, but you still can't stop, even though the substance no longer gets you high." You know, and this is just part of the quote that you gave by
the great
David.
Quote. Yeah,
it is.
He really nailed it.
Yep, and he's
really good.
Part of that other quote. Part of the quote also says, "You are behind bars. You're in a cage, and you can only see bars in every direction. You're in the kind of a hell of a mess that either ends lives or turns them around." Now,
right.
Those words that I haven't done the whole quote, but enslavement to a habit. Now, all of us have habits, and we might not even consider them an enslavement. But when it comes to addiction, when it comes to alcohol addiction, drug addiction, any of that. And there is so much about it that's so confusing, because you'll have some people that are not affected at all, and right. other people that just a whiff of something, and they're in the pits. It's really yeah. amazing. It is quite amazing.
And those are some of the questions I was trying to answer for myself. And I don't pretend to have the answers, but I know that many people who have family members who suffer with this have those same questions. You know, I always wondered, you know, why could I have a glass of wine? And a friend of mine who's a recovering alcoholic says if she has a glass of wine, she'll be closing the bar. Mm-hmm. It won't happen. She can't do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was always grateful that that was not the case for me. But mm-hmm. why? Why is that? Mm-hmm. And there are so many reasons, and it's a very complex thing. Chemical, you know, brain chemistry is a big part of it. Trauma is a big part of it. I found in Cheryl's case, it was abuse that I really didn't know about until I wrote this book.
Uh-huh.
And so it's kind of like a cocktail of, if you'll take that metaphor, of a mixture of things that lead to that being the case, that that some people are affected in this way.
Mm-hmm. Very true. You say the shame surrounding an addict is insidious, and shame is like a virus among us.
Mm.
The reality is, too, that in that world of addiction, it is a world unlike what most people will experience. And as you mentioned, when you discovered that Cheryl had gone through sexual abuse when she was young, and this was by a stepfather, when you found out about it, you were just stunned, because nobody mentioned this. It was all hush-hush, and yet your sister found out about it and left the guy. But this is something, again, you don't talk about it. You don't discuss it. And it's like you're burying a nightmare, and that may or may not have been a trigger for Cheryl with her addiction. But there was also the factors of genetic transferring of trauma. And this is something right. that more and more conversation is being brought forward about. When you were doing your research, you had a lot of details relative to addiction and, you know, the history about the pharmaceutical companies when they came out with OxyContin, you know, and all of that. You've got that there. But it was the genetic research that was really quite eye-opening for you, because at the time that your sister went through what she went through, and then she never thought she could get pregnant because of the horrific
right.
stuff. But in her pregnancy, here she's carrying all of this, they might call it psychological trauma, but it's actually physical trauma as well. And you found and really felt that a lot of the things that Cheryl went through were a result of that. Let's go into that a little bit, because I don't think people really can understand how extraordinarily significant that is.
And, you know, that relates to both myself and Cheryl, you know, being having a mother who was had trauma and was always going through it. I mean, I relate to it because my mother, after losing a child, she had me, you know, very soon after she was still grieving. And so there's that trauma, also. And then Cheryl's, you know, being, having a mother who's been going through trauma her whole life. You know, I don't want to get into all the very technical stuff about, you know, the fetus being bathed in cortisol and that having an effect on their hormones. But there are very specific details about that I've read about. And it gave me an understanding. A lot of the research was done with generations from the Holocaust, and seeing, you know, how generationally the Holocaust affected, you know, children, you know, two and three generations later. And that definitely explained some things to me. It's very fascinating and also eye-opening for me to understand that.
This,
you know, it all goes into who you are.
Yes.
That you're not even aware of.
Mm-hmm. It's on a subconscious level. It's on a cellular level, but it also is in that memory that goes into the subconscious content that we carry around and the triggers sometimes that cause us to react as we do. Rachel Yehudu, who is the professor of psychiatry and neuroscience and the director of the Traumatic Stress Studies Division at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and she's also the director of the Mental Health Patient Care Center at the James J. Peters VA Medical Center in New York City. You know, this kind of research is relatively new. Although among indigenous cultures, often this was spoken of. And, you know, in the Bible it says the sins of the father visit seven generations. You know, you have all of these different quotes from ancient scripts.
Right.
So there has been this awareness, but in our time and in our culture, we're becoming aware of that on a level that really can empower one to understand why sometimes negotiations with people that have lived through traumas, it's very hard to reach them because they are unaware of how they're carrying all of this subconscious fear and anxiety and stress. And they've inherited it, may not have even been present in their life, but they've got it and they're living it. It's really a phenomenal, tremendous step, I think, in
I agree. And I think, you know, the fact that there are some new techniques in therapies that are helping people uncover, you know, some of these underlying reasons, you know, that they may turn to drugs that they are not aware of at all is very important work that's being done and helping people.
One of the biggest challenges that you had was really understanding the patternings of addicts. And it's like a state of denial. We sometimes think that there is a magic bullet that's going to be able to fix somebody. And you had a conversation with, after Cheryl's death, with a woman by the name of Tiffany that was associated with a very fine organization. And she had been an addict herself, and she told you that it was nobody's fault, it wasn't your fault, and you were not to feel guilty. That conversation you had with Tiffany, that helped you a great deal, did it not?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think she said to me it was just a deep hole that she was in when she was in the depths of her own addiction, and you know, there was nothing anybody could do until she came to it herself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was very helpful. And I'm still in touch with her, as a matter of fact, which is great.
Yes,
and
it is.
She's doing
great.
Okay.
Yes, yes. And it is a journey. It is a lifelong journey that when someone has followed that path and they're able to turn it around, it makes a huge difference. But they always have to be aware of that shadow that is there, and, you know, working with that. So I think it's great that you're still in touch with her. And also, one of the things that she shared with you is that, as you just mentioned, the individual has to be willing to make the change. And you did a lot of research on Cheryl after she died. So
yeah, I did.
That was real eye-opening for you as well, was it not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things since, you know, from doing other kinds of writing from, you know, starting as a reporter and then, you know, I did marketing writing, but all the writing that I did, my go-to technique was to just gather all of the information first and from wherever I could, all the evidence and see where it took me and what I thought about it in this case. And so I got hold of her journal after she died, and I got hold of her cell phone, and I unearthed her text messages. This was a cell phone I actually had sent her because I couldn't keep in touch with her during the last last few months of her life. And I saw the text messages going back and forth, and I actually made up a spreadsheet of, you know, when she sent different messages, and it certainly opened my eyes to the things I was lied to about. And, you know, in one text message, she would be telling me, oh, I have two interviews tomorrow for, you know, jobs, and I'm looking at this place to try to, you know, get a room. And then literally, like, 2 minutes later, I see a text to somebody else, and she's buying drugs. And, you know, that was, I mean, that is what will happen. That's what will happen.
I found it very interesting that in your research, you said there's no legal requirement for rehabilitation facilities to be accredited. And I was surprised by that. I honestly thought that there were protocols that had to be followed by these rehab facilities, and I know some of them are just extraordinarily expensive. Most people aren't going to be able to afford them. And there are different groups that, you know, try to help people, but they don't have a lot in funds, and it's a real challenge for them.
And there are accreditations that people can look for. I mean, I know in New York especially that, you know, they can look for, you know, certified addiction counselors. And actually, even since I've finished writing this book, there are more things that you can look for in a rehab facility and in counseling, but it's important to look for them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important not to just go to a place that will take your money and, you know, it's run by people who are not accredited or, you know, don't have the educational background to help. And so I think it's very important to look at the credentials of any place that you send a loved one or you yourself go to.
In fact, you say there are physicians who are accredited addiction specialists. They're board certified in addiction medicine.
Right.
So anyone listening, you need to know that there are those resources. And she has so much information, Judy does, in her book. And what I also wanted to say that you talk about Louisville, Kentucky. Now, that was a place where Cheryl was, and I was astonished that you said it had a huge percentage. Drug-related deaths rose 900% in 10 years. That is astronomical.
It's been horrible. It's one of the places in the country that was hit very hard by the opioid crisis.
Wow. And there's,
and I was also surprised that even when, you know, homeless people are looking for places to be, and many of us homeless people do suffer from substance use disorder. It's mostly for men. There's a very small percentage of beds are for women. And I found that very, very upsetting when I was trying to find a place for many to be. And that, you know, there was another reason that I called this white flag, because that's the only way that she found a bed during a very cold winter in Louisville, was when the weather got so cold that they had to raise their white flag. They used to raise them literally, a real white flag, and then it's more digital now of a white flag that, you know, yes, you can come in even if we don't have beds, because we know being out in the cold will be death for you. So that's part of the white flag as well.
And that's why you chose the title White Flag for your publication.
Yeah, it's got a, you know, triple meaning for me.
Narcan. Let's talk about that for a minute, because that's an antidote that apparently most paramedics carry in their toolkits. But this is to assist with overdose victims. I know I did read an article and information about how librarians in certain areas of the country, they had so many overdose victims that were around the library that they ended up carrying Narcan, and they were trained on how to administer it. And that was something I thought, my goodness, a person training to be a librarian, that's the last thing that they're going to think that they're going to have to do. And yet this has become, the opioid situation has become so serious. But it's not just the OxyContin. It is heroin. It is the fentanyl that is often combined with it, which will kill people. It's horrible stuff. And this was something that you found in your sister's last phase, although she was really in very bad physical shape when you got the medical report of what, you know, what was happening when she died. She was in emergency services, but they administered fentanyl to her. And
yeah, that was a very strange thing, and I'm not sure why that happened, but it was certainly right there in the medical report. What I was more upset about finding was that they didn't administer Narcan at the site of when they found her, which would have may have saved her.
Uh-huh.
It may have saved her. I think they tried giving it to her either on the way to the hospital or at the hospital, but not at the site, and I think it was too late by the time they tried it.
Yes.
You know, and I am encouraged that more and more, you know, police are carrying Narcan, and it's becoming something that is out there more and more and required by, you know, police and anybody in public service. And I guess librarians now count as those people.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
At the end of your book, you wrote a letter to Cheryl, and it's a very powerful letter. And I think that it enabled you to a degree to realize you had done everything you really were capable of doing without knowing what you learned later on. And you even state how, I will use the word naive and unaware you were of the addiction behaviors and the aspect of lying. And that was something that you, when you did your research after she had died, you found was very, very real. That must have had quite an effect on you.
Yeah, finding out, you know, with the lies and the things that I could have known that would have helped me understand better. Again, it's that trauma of silence again, also. And, you know, I think the best thing that I came to know was that Cheryl really, she didn't want to be an addict. And there was just this, like I said in that letter, you know, there was a chasm between her intentions and her actions. And that was the change in brain chemistry. And I tried to, at that point, just remember her as, you know, the sweet soul that she was, and the person that she was. And I think that's the message I would give to people, really. If they have a loved one who has substance use disorder, remember who they are. They're still that person that you love. They're still them, and they need to be treated as a human being, even as you protect yourself from the lies that you will get. But to keep them alive until hopefully they come to their own white flag is what I would hope people can do.
It's a journey I would not wish for anyone, because it's a very tough situation to be able to really understand. But I think also that there has been so much false information regarding the effect of narcotics on the body. And that is something you bring out as well. In these times that we're in, it is very difficult. Yes, that's true. But the addiction, when it happens, it totally takes over. It is a dark shadow that literally consumes the person that's consuming the substance. And it is a very, very dark hole. And there is help out there. But we have to also be aware of, like you said, to protect ourselves and to be alert to the fact we do what we can. But it does get to what Tiffany said, and that is it's a choice that someone has to make. And Tiffany knew, because she had made that choice. And You are still in touch with her today, which I think is very powerful. But your book, White Flag, brings so many different components together that I think anyone who has a member of the family or a very good friend, and you're watching the self-destruction that so often follows this, there are so many different aspects to it. And you have a comment in there about one man who said that in his dealing with addicts, whether it was alcohol or drugs, that almost always they had gone through very severe trauma in their young years, and he had documented and all of this. So you have another perspective that goes along with it.
That was Gabor Mate, the physician, the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Judy Mandel, people can be in touch with you and can find out more about your work, your previous book, about your family as well. And it's Judy Mandel, and that's M like Mary, A-N-D like Donna, E-L, .com. And they'll be able to find out some resources and other things on your website. I'm so delighted we've had this chance to share your message with people, because I think the book White Flag is, in a sense, I know you call it a memoir, but it's also an expose on what people go through on different levels, all parties engaged, and how important it is to be able to realize that there's more than one aspect that creates this environment that creates such distortion in people's lives. Judy Mandel, I want to thank you for being my guest.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. We're saying goodbye to Judy Mandel. We're going to be taking a break here. And after that, we'll be continuing with the show. I am in studio. I had people saying, Don, I want you to let me know when you're in studio. I am in studio this evening. And if you want to talk to me, 253-582-5597. We're going to be right back. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Tomorrow evening, we're going to be talking about the breakthrough limits of the brain with Joseph Selby. Also, we're going to be having an upcoming programs, microdosing with Amanita Muscaria. Olga Perry is going to be discussing that, and then activating your cosmic DNA with Eva Marquez, and then Sane Asylums, S-A-N-E Asylums with Jerry Cantor. The history is amazing. The Road Ahead and the Miles Behind with Mike LaGuardia, and the 15-Minute Pause with Michelle Burke, and Alamani De Silva is going to be my guest. Both ladies will be on with me, one from England and the other one from the U.S. Well, if you want to know about the guests that are coming up, like us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter, and my assistant Deb will be sure to keep the postings for you there. And she also posts my upcoming events, and I want to take the opportunity to thank the people at the Psychic Spectrum. We had a fabulous turnout last night, and my my talk on remote viewing, well, it was well received. And I really appreciated all the people that came out, because there's so many fall events going on in the local area that lots of times, you know, people are out and about doing different things. The weather's absolutely gorgeous here, but we had a marvelous turnout, and I was just so pleased. So there's that. And then just know that on the 24th of this month, I'm going to be appearing at the Emerald Spiral event for those of you in the state of Washington, at the Kent Commons Center in Kent, Washington. The hours will be 10 to 4. If you want to find out more information about this event, there will not be speakers, but I'm going to be in booth number 30. I will be available for many sessions, as well as being able to bring in oodles and oodles of books. Yes, so we're going to have that. I want to take this opportunity to share my thoughts about Queen Elizabeth. I know she died. She was 96 years of age. And with her beloved husband passing away last year, it was not really too much of a surprise that she moved on within a short period of time after his death. There is an era that has come to an end, and this is a woman that I think is going to be remembered in history in a very, very special way. Because at the time she ended up becoming queen, and you're going to hear this over and over again, because she is recognized as a very unique woman, and she was in a position during the Second World War where she learned how to be a mechanic. It was a world that was very much unlike the world we are seeing and living in today. And in 96 years of life, the transitions that that woman saw and the adaptations that she had to go through, the challenges she faced publicly because she didn't have much of a private life, and she was, for the people of England, a representation, really, of someone that had tremendous courage and was, and I heard this word used, and I really thought it applied to her. She was steadfast. She was consistent in who she was. She didn't try to be somebody else. She was herself. She's a very good example to those of us living today, for men and women both, to understand the value of character. And I think she represented that to a very significant degree. She was a human being that was thrust into a positioning that she carried. She was the longest and is the longest reigning monarch in English history. She surpassed Queen Victoria, and the legacy that she left was just amazing. So she has such a symbology in the mind of people around the world, and I really think that that symbology is a very positive one. And it's something that the British people have relied upon. And this is something that, well, it's going to be a big change with Philip coming in as king. And the shoes she left behind to fill may seem rather tight and small on his feet, so to speak. But I'll tell you what, I think, again, she set a standard of excellence, of sophistication, of civility, of thoughtfulness in her communication, and more than anything else, the complete dedication to the job she had been assigned, even up to the last moments of her death. I'm so grateful that I, in my lifetime, had the privilege of being aware of a woman who, well, she made a lot of difference in the lives and the thinking of millions of people around the world. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. Well, a friend of mine had sent me a recipe that I thought I would share with you, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the culinary dishes, too, of China. And Chinese food, I'm always in awe about people who have this phenomenal background with Chinese cooking. And I remember watching a series of programs through, I don't remember what the channel was, But the different recipes, the different ways that people cooked in the different areas of China. Of course, China is a massive country. And some foods were not available in certain areas of China that were available in others. And what people did and how they adapted in their environments and the things that they learned about food and wellness, nutrition, and all kinds of things. It's just the history in China is really fascinating. But before I do that, I wanted to share a thought that was apparently found by a person by the name of Eric, and it was about President Calvin Coolidge. And he once invited, now this is a true story, he once invited friends from his hometown to dine with him at the White House. Now, they were very concerned because they did not know the etiquette that would be needed to be exhibited at the White House dinner. So because they were so concerned about their table manners, the guests decided that they would do everything that Calvin Coolidge was going to do when he was eating and drinking or whatever. Well, you know what? It worked beautifully. They would wait. He was the first one that was to be eating anything. So they'd watch what fork he used, what knife he used, what he would do with his glass of wine or whatever was served. Well, it came to dessert time. Coffee was being served. They watched him. The president poured his coffee into the saucer. The guest did the same. Coolidge added sugar and cream into that saucer. His guests did exactly the same. Then what Coolidge did, he bent over and put his saucer on the floor for the cat. You know, sometimes, and I read that, and I just burst out laughing because I thought, how many times do we look at someone, we admire that person, and we go, oh, I just want to be just like them. And it brought back a memory to me. And this was something in the early days of my marriage. And my husband and I had the opportunity to attend a very formal function. Now, believe me, both of us had been taught about etiquette. We'd both read about etiquette. But neither one of us had read about the etiquette of an extremely formal dinner. And we were sitting at a table. The room was packed. And in front of us, we were just stunned on this table for two that we were sitting at, that there were 12 forks to our left and 12 knives and 12 spoons to our right. And then there were four or five spoons that were above our plate. And we just sat there and we looked at each other. And it was just so funny. Because what happened is that I said very quietly to my husband, do you know what we're supposed to do? And I just used simple words like that. And my husband said, no, I haven't a clue. And we were so tightly packed in the room with all of these other people. There was a woman sitting at a table right adjacent to us. And she said, is this your first time at an event like this? And we said, yes. She said, I'll give you a tip. Go from the outside in. So use the outside course. Because we were going to be served 12 to 13 courses for this big formal event. Do you know, we followed her instructions. Everything went beautifully. It is really something to acknowledge what you don't know. And this was an event that stayed very strongly in our mind because we had a fabulous, fabulous evening. But I just wanted to share that with you. I love the story about Calvin Coolidge and then putting the saucer on the floor for the cat. I imagine that the people sitting there felt mortified because they had no cat to give their coffee in the saucer to. I think we have a caller. Let's see if we have someone on the line. Hi, this is Donna. Welcome to the show. What's your first name or initial? Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. I put you on. I'm so sorry. My finger slipped and I had it on mute accidentally.
Oh, not a problem. So, first name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Lisa in Tucson.
All right, Lisa, welcome to the show. And I want you to know that first thing right off the bat, you've got to have some patience with some situations that are around you. You have no control over what people are thinking or what they're feeling. And I want to say, be a good listener. Asking questions might be a good thing, but be thoughtful with your questions, because what you want to do is really find out what the facts are. And whatever this is engaging, being a good listener is going to give you more information if you can ask questions that are going to enable a person to reveal to you what information and details you need to have so that you can take care of the decisions and the supplying of information that you may need to give to whomever you're interacting with. And I'm looking at you asking yourself the question, am I ever going to get to the point where I will not feel so stressed about doing this? And I'm going to say yes. And I don't think it's going to take you all that long. I think when you can relinquish the concern about perfection, relax and just do what you know you need to do and allow people to give you the information that you need in a way and manner that is so comfortable for them that they're at ease and that you have their trust, that is the best way to work it. And you're going to find yourself being able to complete the shift of changes that you started to implement in the latter part of spring, have moved forward with deliberate effort. And this is something that I think is going to be very significant for you. You have the opportunity to be able to bring into closure certain components that you have been so highly stressed about. And I think that it is really going to work for you. And not trying to control everything, not trying to put everything into what you feel as the perceived hole that it needs to be in. Allow things to open up for you. That's what I'm looking at. And asking questions and just listening, you're going to find that things are going to go into the right hole, the right place, in the right timing. And this is a part of the process. This is part of what you're evolving through. And that, I think, is going to be when you're going to start seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. That's the best way I know how to put it right at this moment. So just be patient. You're a hard worker. You are a perfectionist in many respects, and I think it's not wrong to aim for perfection. The key is to know when it's okay to pull back and let things flow as they need to flow. I don't know if I'm making sense to you or not, but I just really think that you put yourself under a lot of stress and pressure that is just not really necessary to be experienced. But it's a patterning, and it's one that I think you're going to be shifting. I think you're going to go into 2023 with a different demeanor. And you'll be even more successful with what you're wanting to achieve because of that. Do you have a question for me?
Oh, thank you. I do. I lost a significant other after being together for 22 years. And we weren't married, but we shared a lot of everything, and it was all legal. You know, we had legal documents stating that if I died, it would go to him. If he died, it would come to me. I'm trying to find a will. Do you see me locating a will?
I'm looking. I'm looking at two different documents. So, did you have any copies of what he did?
Not a will. It was unexpected that he passed. And he didn't expect to pass. I didn't expect him to pass. And we would have done things differently had we known he was going to pass.
Do you know about his attorney?
Oh, that. I have an attorney and...
No, his attorney. The attorney he worked with.
Well, I found a name. We shared a house together, and I'm going through papers. And I did find a name of a lawyer, and in this day and age, it's not politically correct to say ethnic groups, but my significant other was Jewish, and the lawyer's name looks Jewish. And so I'm thinking about calling the lawyer and letting him know. But I thought maybe I don't have to call. Maybe they would.
No, that's incorrect. You're incorrect. If your significant partner had worked with this attorney, and this attorney was given the will, or if he made a will, that is important. Now, let me ask you this. Did you make a will, a statement? Was there any kind of a statement that was agreed upon by both of you and signed? Now, the properties already state, from what you've just said, that you are to be given this. I mean, you were joint owners on properties. So this is something, your name is on there. It's automatically going to go to you. So that's a good thing. That's very good. And in a court of law, that's going to be totally fine and perfect. But if you're wanting to find out about a will relative to some other aspects of things, then you should contact the attorney, and he is under no obligation to notify you unless he is necessarily aware of that. He may not even be aware that your partner died. So I would say pick up the telephone and call the man.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's what you need to do. If all of the assets that the two of you invested in together, it's joint, then that is something that can be settled. And if, dependent on what goes on in the state that you're in, that where you have these properties, you may or may not have to go into probate. But that's why wills are so important. That because your name is on the whatever agreements you had, that is, you know, that's legit in a court of law. So this is something that I think is, you know, the questions you have about the other aspects that you're concerned with, you would need to have a copy of the will. And if you don't have a copy of the will, if he's got any surviving family members, they may not have a copy either. He may be didn't make one.
Did you pick up, because he said he didn't have family. Do you pick up that there might be someone coming forward?
Coming forward for what?
Well, that there might be some throwback, to a family member that might try to contest.
I wouldn't worry about that. I think what you really should do, you need to contact an attorney. If you have one yourself, okay, you need to sit down with this attorney. And are all the properties and assets that the two of you had together for 10 years, or whatever time frame it was, are they all in one state?
Yeah, and also they're mine. I mean, they're legally mine now. I've gotten information on that.
All right, so you don't have anything to worry about. You don't have anything to worry about. Well, there may be family members, but this was a property agreement between you and him. This was a business.
That part
is investment. Yeah, so this isn't going to be it. But no, I don't think anybody's going to come after you if that's what you're concerned about.
Well, there are other assets, though. And I think he would have put everything in a will. And I think he did that toward the end.
I'm not picking up on anything like that. So you can, again, this is something, remember what I gave you in the beginning in the way of information. You're trying to control everything. So look at having time with an attorney. Sit down, and if you're going through documents that you have in hand, go through everything that you've got. Look at all of the different pieces. But if he did not write a will, which sadly a lot of people don't, if he didn't write a will, then if a family member comes in and says, well, we want his watch, we want this, that, or the other, that's going to be between you and them. But the assets that you have, for example, the house that you're living in, all of that is in your name now. All of that belongs to you. They're not going to be able to do anything with that. And they're not going to want to. I'm not seeing anybody coming in and coming after you.
Okay. Yeah, I think there are a lot more assets, though. And I just, I have talked to my attorney, and I will call the other attorney's name that I discovered recently.
I would. And find out. Say, this is a concern of mine, but you have what you have, and whatever other assets, if your name is on not on them, then the family members are going to have first tabs on it, not you.
Yeah.
So that's just real. That's nothing phenomenally unusual. And the fact that you were not married legally, then there is not that kind of a contract, which is what a marriage is. It's a contract, a legal contract. So there's no way, and I don't know that the family members are necessarily going to advise you of anything of that nature.
No.
So I think, again, there is this clarity that you are going to have, and you just need to make it okay to lay certain things to rest if you're not able to get a resolution on this. But do go through, as you already are. You're doing the right thing, and you're finding out about different people, and you're finding different documents. And actually, I'm not picking up any information on a will. Now, that doesn't mean it couldn't exist. I'm not picking up anything on it. So I'm being very honest with you. But that is something, sounds to me like you have done what's appropriate, and you've taken care of all the legal aspects relative to what assets the two of you shared, which is good. And the rest, well, you're just going to have to do the rest of the investigation to the best of your capability.
I know he had a safety deposit box at the bank, and I took the death certificate there. And we weren't married, you know, I can't.
That's right. You weren't on the security box, so you can't have access to it.
So I know that there are things in that safety security box, like documents and things that even quite possibly, I'm like 98% sure if there's a will, it would be there.
Well, I would just suggest what I suggested before, and that is call the attorney that he worked with and notify the attorney and see if there was a will that was through him, and I know that he would want to notify the family, and then he would also notify you.
Okay.
But that's the recourse that you're going to have to look at, because you cannot have access to that security box, and you don't know, you know, you don't know about anybody else unless you got some kind of a court order to, you know, have that opened. And if you found a key that he left, because you lived together for 10 years, that key.
I have the key.
Okay, if you have the key, you may need to get a legal order to open that security box.
They won't let me. I've already talked to them, and I took the death.
No, you're talking to the bank. I would say talk to the attorney and see what could be done. You might be able to see that box opened and the family notified, so as well as yourself. So this is important. There's ways that this could be worked. Otherwise, it's going to stay in the bank, and nobody's ever going to get it. It'll all go to the state.
Yeah.
All right. So talk to an attorney and see what recourse you might have, and talk to the attorney that, you know, you've got your attorney. You need to talk to the other attorney that you found on the records that he had processed. Follow through with that, Lisa. And I'm going to have to stop here, dear. I've got to go.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Donna Sebo here. You. I'm saying goodbye, and we are going to talk again soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.